Hello, everyone, and welcome to a not Big Brother 19 live feed update, but this is a very special podcast that I've brought to you today. I'm here with John Krause, and we are going to talk about the psychology of Big Brother dictatorships. John, can you just, like, this is RHAP. I'm Taryn Armstrong, your host, as always. But just can we get an introduction to you, your psychology background, and what this podcast is going to be about?
Yeah, sure. So I've discussed this before, but I guess it's always good to sort of reiterate when we start talking about semi-serious things. I am trained as a psychologist. In a different lifetime, I was a psychologist for a while. I'm still technically licensed for like another 6 months or so. So I have a bachelor's degree and a master's degree in clinical psychology, but I also have done lots of studying in things like family psychology and things like social psychology and things like personality psychology. And so watching Big Brother this season, I was just sort of reminded, especially lately, we've been talking about how Paul's running the show and Paul is being a dictator, and we've been comparing him to other players such as Boston Rob in Survivor and also Derek in Big Brother. And it made me think, like, why does this happen time and time again? Why is this going on? And it made me pull out my old psychology, my old sociology textbooks. And I think that there is an interesting discussion to be had. I think that we can talk about a couple interesting topics in psychology and sociology, and also just in history, that might give us a new perspective on why this happens in the Big Brother house and in Survivor.
Yes, awesome. So we will be talking all about that, the psychology stuff. And then we do have some spoilers from Reddit for who won the HOH after the double eviction. We will talk about that and the implications of that. At the end of the show, we'll talk about spoilers. This is not a spoiler show, so we will clearly mark when the spoilers are going to start happening. Right now, we are only talking about just this season as a whole and Paul's influence on it, and really Big Brother as a whole, and even Survivor to some extent. What's happened here with all this stuff. So let's get right into this. This came about because we were texting back and forth and you're like, you know, this really reminds me of like some like dictatorships and like cult of personality. Can you walk me through this?
Yeah. Okay. So before we get started, let's kind of lay out the ground rules here. I figured that this is a discussion. A lot of this is sort of psych 101, sociology 101. So you may be familiar with it. The listeners, a lot of them probably are familiar with some of it. So I'm not trying to necessarily teach you anything, but it's a discussion. So let's have a nice back and forth here. If there's anything you don't understand or you think I'm way off on, call me out on it. That's totally fine. And there are also a few caveats, a few things I want to say before we get too embroiled into this. Number one, any discussion of science and history is inherently a very serious and political thing. My goal is not to be too serious here. We are talking about a goofy reality TV show with, you know, farty Uncle Austin and all that stuff. I also don't want to be too political, but it's going to come up. So that's just sort of a warning up front. And the other thing, too, is I'm going to be talking about stuff like dictatorships today. These are very serious things. These are real atrocities that have happened and continue to happen in the real world. I'm not trying to trivialize those things by comparing them to the Big Brother house. I'm also not trying to villainize people like Paul and compare them to truly evil, awful people in history. I just think that there are some interesting comparisons to be made, and we can learn a lot about human behavior, both amongst ourselves in the real world and also amongst players in these games, because these games are social experiments. They are actual humans interacting with each other. So those are things I want to say up front here. I don't want to get too heated, too serious, and I don't want to trivialize actual serious bad things that happen in the real world.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's part of the interesting stuff about Big Brother and Survivor and watching these shows, is that you do get to kind of like make interpretations on, you know, how these people are acting and why. And obviously it's all, you know, we're just people talking about a TV show here. We're not like we're not political pundits or anything like that. So if you feel like this is something that might offend you or upset you in any way, feel free to not listen. This is for anybody that would enjoy this lighthearted discussion about something that is, I think, interesting to me at least, at the very least. So I'm excited to start talking about this. So we've seen this happen a few times now, where it's like, you know, between Boston Rob, maybe Kim on Survivor as well. We've seen it with Derek and now Paul. We even saw it with Paulie to a smaller extent last season before he got overthrown. So how does this come about that these people gain so much control?
Yeah, so basically, I think that sort of the topic discussion here is we see it time and time again. I'm guilty of saying this. You are. Everyone who goes on these podcasts and on Twitter, we always say, why are these people being such sheep? Why do they let this happen? There's clearly, right now, Paul in the house, but we have clearly Boston Rob. Clearly, I think Kim is definitely another good example. Clearly, Derek. Why don't they just vote these people out? Why are they being such sheep? If I were in the house, I would never stand for this. And so I think that there are a couple things, and we're going to have a couple of things that we're going to hit, and then I'll describe them and then we'll discuss them. There are a couple different things in social psychology and in traditional psychology that I believe that we can learn that this sort of thing is not that crazy. It's actually, I would say, expected to happen from time to time. And I think that whether we like to believe it or not, it could happen to us too. This is the kind of thing that it's normal. It's a normal part of the human brain when you get into certain group dynamics and into certain environments. And it's the kind of thing that we would predict happening. And even if we were in the house, it might happen to us too. So I guess if we're going to be biased in any way, this podcast might kind of take a little bit of the blame off of the Alexes and the Christmases in the house a little bit.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is something that I think a lot of people, and even listening to this podcast, I'm sure a lot of people would be like, well, I mean, you're talking about this, but it definitely wouldn't happen. If I was in that house, I would be standing up to Paul. I would be turning on him. I would be getting him out of the house. I mean, tons of former players have said that on Twitter. I mean, a lot of people have gone and said, you know, like, these people are ridiculous. They're idiots for following Paul. Like, we need a better cast. Like, if there were smarter people in there, then they could surely do something about Paul. But what you're saying is that to some extent, at the very least, this is actually kind of normal behavior.
Yes, absolutely. So let's dive into it. I have a couple different experiments and theories that I want to cover, and I'm going to give a little sort of little brief outline, and then we can have a little back and forth on whether you think that this applies or not, and what your thoughts are. So the first thing I want to talk about, this is definitely a psych 101 thing. If you've ever taken a psych class, you're definitely talking about the Milgram experiment, Stanley Milgram's experiment with electric shocks. This was an experiment that was done in the 60s, back in 1961. And basically what you'd had is you had three people in a room. There was a professor or a scientist who is an authority figure. And then there are two people that are test subjects. And they randomly draw cards. One of them gets this thing that says teacher, and one of them gets this thing that says learner. And the learner gets plugged into this apparatus that is all like electronics. They get basically a bunch of electric prods attached to their body. And then they have to learn a series of word associations. And then the actual experiment begins. And so what happens is they get asked a question. And if the learner gets the question wrong, then the teacher is directed to electrically shock that person. They have a machine and they push a button and they give them an electric shock. And every time the learner gets a question wrong, the shock increases. It goes up and up and up. They get shocked more and more and more extremely until there's actually on the machine, there's one that's at the very high end that actually says danger could be fatal. All right. So the way that this actually works is that the cards are stacked. There's only one person being sort of experimented on, and that is the person that is in the teacher role. So the person that gets the learner card always gets the learner card, and they're a cohort. They're also another scientist. And what is being experimented on is how far is this person willing to go? How far are they willing to go to shock another person? And it's also very important to note that there was actually nothing was actually plugged in. So the person that is being shocked, they're an actor, right? So you probably have your ideas and you probably think of yourself in this role. Like, I would never hurt another person, or I would, once it got to a point where the person said, please stop, I would quit. And that's what a lot of other students and scientists predicted would happen in this experiment. They were like, oh, most people are going to quit by a certain point. Okay. What actually ended up happening in this experiment was 65% of the participants, more than half, gave every single electric shock all the way up to and including the lethal dose. 65%. Many more than that, closer to 90%, even though the other people did quit before the end, almost 90% of them continued until the actor pretended to pass out. They continued to shock the person after the person passed out and stopped answering questions. And also important to note is the people who did quit before the end never made any comments about this is morally wrong, this is inappropriate. They never made any comments about the morality of anything. They didn't even check on the health of the victim, the person who looked like they were injured. A lot of the people who quit just said, I don't want to do this anymore, and then they left. And these results have been replicated many times over the last 50-some years in multiple countries. Okay? And the conclusions here are that people listen to what they're told. They do what they're told. Most people do what they're told, even if it's against their own self-interest. If there's an authority figure in the room, in this experiment, it was the scientist figure, they do what they're told. And there are a lot of obvious comparisons to real-world stuff here. This experiment was devised in the wake of the Nuremberg trials after World War II. This is the Stanley Milgram was like, I want to see how culpable these people, because during those trials, the Nazis were like, I was just doing what I was told. I didn't want to do it. I was just listening to the authority figure. And Stanley Milgram was like, let's actually test that. All right. So I have a couple comparisons to the Big Brother house, but what are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I've always, you know, this has always been an interesting study to me. This, along with the next one, I think we'll probably be talking about the Stanford Prison Experiment.
Yep.
But like the idea of there being an authority figure, I think it really does apply to this season in particular, because Paul comes in as a veteran of the game, and he makes it very, very clear right from the get-go that I've played this before. And we all got so annoyed because we called it vet-splaining. He was just constantly talking about his experience and how he knows better. But what it did was it set him up as an authority figure.
Exactly.
And it gave the other people permission to do what he told them to do. And when we look at the behavior that they're exhibiting in terms of, like, you know, quote unquote bullying other people or getting into fights, it's usually at his behest, and I think they feel like legitimate in doing it. They feel legitimized because somebody told them to do it, an authority figure told them to do it, and they don't feel any sort of moral qualms about it. And I think that is very easily seen as a direct comparison to the Milgram experiment here.
Yeah, I would completely agree. My notes, as it relates to these reality shows, is definitely true. I wrote down that these players, especially when they are returning players, are seen as authorities. But even Derek, who was not a returning player, he was seen as an authority. He was seen as a trusted source of sort of information in his season. And you could say the same thing about Kim, as opposed to, obviously, with people like Boston Rob and people like Paul, they're definitely seen as authority figures. They come into the game already as known entities. They're also very quick to follow orders a lot of times, right? Even if it's against their own self-interest. So that's important to note, too. Two quotes from Stanley Milgram that I wrote down. These are direct quotes. I think these are very applicable, too. So this is first one. A subject who has neither ability nor expertise to make decisions, especially in a crisis, will leave decision making to the group and its hierarchy. Right? Big Brother is nothing if not a crisis. You're not in a normal situation. You are in a heightened, stressful situation. You guys interview people who played the game time and time again. I would say that qualifies as a crisis, and it's much easier. It's so much easier on your brain and your psyche, and it's your shoulders go down if you are leaving the decision making to somebody else. Another quote, and this relates very closely to what Jason said last night in the double eviction. This is another quote from Stanley Milgram. The essence of obedience consists in the fact that a person comes to view themselves as the instrument for carrying out another person's wishes, and they therefore no longer see themselves as responsible for their actions. That's basically what Jason said in his speech last night, right?
Yeah, it's also what Alex said when she put Cody up on the block. I washed my hands of this. Like, this wasn't my decision. Like, it was up to the house. And people talk about that all the time. Like, it's the house decision. It's a house vote. It's not up to me. That really is a way for them to cleanse themselves of responsibility.
Exactly. And so I think that if we want to delve into the brains of these players playing, they may know that they are acting against their own self-interest. They may know when these fights break out and people are attacking and bullying other players that that's not good. They know it in their brains and in their hearts, but it's so hard to actually break out of that. And an experiment like this shows that time and time again, normal people, people that are average, and we are all on average, behave that way in these situations.
Yeah, and I think the most telling part about this again is that these people in the Milgram experiment, they would never have said that they were capable of doing that sort of thing, and everybody who you know goes into that experiment would say, I would never do that. And then in that situation, when you think it's real, you fall into that trap, like almost everybody does. And that's an aspect of psychology that always has fascinated me, is that like you can be aware of all your biases, logical fallacies, but you will still always fall into those traps. There's nothing that you can really do. You will always overestimate your ability to overcome your biases, and I think this is a prime example.
Yeah, you know, not to turn the conversation towards me too much, but like I recently played Sequester. You on the Terran Show interviewed Audrey about her experience in the Big Brother house and also creating that game. And I experienced that a little bit to my own detriment, in that I knew what the right moves were. And oftentimes I had a hard time actually doing them, even though I knew what to do. You know what I mean? So it's weird when you actually experience it, because your brain is like, what are you doing? You should do A. But it's like, yeah, but I'm going to do B anyway. It's almost like an out of body experience. And so I do want to move now. We'll do the Stanford prison experiment, because you brought that up. So what do you know about the Stanford prison experiment?
Well, from my knowledge, it was an experiment that was set up. They took a group of people and they split them into two different groups.
Yep.
And one of them was the group of prisoners, quote unquote prisoners, and the other group was the prison guards. And I believe this only went on for a few days before it ultimately had to be shut down, because just going through the motions of having one group have authority over the other group, it dehumanized that other group, and that authority just really took control, and they started really abusing their power over these other these quote unquote prisoners.
Absolutely. You have it totally right. So this is also called the Zimbardo experiment, because it was conducted by a guy named Philip Zimbardo. It's also called the Stanford prison experiment because it happened at Stanford. But basically, a group of students were randomly divided up into two different groups. And they were like, okay, you guys, you're the prisoners. You guys, you are the guards. And this was done in a dorm room. So, like, they kind of locked down this dorm room for a few days. And from day one, it was kind of like, this is kind of silly, right? A lot of these students were friends with each other. It's like a dorm room situation, right? But very, very quickly, people started taking to heart. They started spontaneously playing into their roles. And this experiment was supposed to last for several weeks, and it ended up being disbanded in only 6 days because of the extreme abuses that were going on. Many of the prisoners started passively accepting abuse from guards. Many of the guards harassed both mentally and physically the prisoners. And interestingly enough, many prisoners harassed other prisoners at the guards' behest. So a lot of the guards were saying, hey, you pick on that person. And they would do it. Another interesting thing to talk about is the fact that all of the prisoners were given a number. They were not referred to by their names. They were, hey, you were prisoner number 123 or 567 or whatever. And after a few days, the prisoners started referring to themselves by their numbers. They started losing their own sense of identity in this experiment. Philip Zimbardo, another reason that he canceled the experiment after 6 days was that he was playing the part of the warden. And he found himself also conducting and allowing abuses to happen over just a few different days. So I think that the big takeaway from this experiment is that people's personalities and behaviors, we like to think of ourselves as having what we call internal or dispositional attribution. You have your own idea of who you are, what your personality is, what your behavior is. And it's something that is internal. We think of it as something that is inherent within us. But experiments like these, the takeaway is that a lot of your personality, a lot of your behavior is actually caused by external or situational attributions, where if you are given a label, you are the prison guard. That can actually change your behavior and that can change your personality. And I think, again, the attributions to the Big Brother house are obvious.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we see that in terms of, like, even just when you win HOH, you feel, we call it HOH-itis, but, yep, like, your identity in the game changes, you feel powerful, and people who never win HOH often have a completely different outlook on the game, because they've never held that power. And then, obviously, with somebody like Paul, I mean, even just looking at Paul's mentality here, he goes into the game as a vet, as somebody who failed last time. He came into this game, and the very first thing we saw of him on the feeds was him talking in a very, like, somewhat humble manner. Like, I'm doing my best here. I'm trying to, like, stay under the radar and do this the way that I can. But then, like, as time went on and he realized how much power he had in the house, you could see, like, the gears shifting. And I think we saw it in Jason to some extent as well, in Big Brother OTT, where the personality almost changes the more, like, power you hold over other people.
I think that you can make comparisons to any returnee season of either of these shows. You are a different person when you come back in, because you have applied the label to yourself, or the producers have, that you are a returnee, and there are expectations for that returnee. And that can change how you behave in the house. When you see yourself as a leader or as a vet, that can definitely change your behavior. And so another thing I think, too, is we can see these comparisons with a lot of the fighting and the bullying. I see a lot of Josh in the Stanford Prison Experiment, where Paul says, Josh, you know, you're the bulldog. You're the one, like, go get the pots and pans. That's your thing. You're the pots and pans guy. Johnny Pots and Pans. And, like, Josh goes into that. It changes his behavior. But then Josh wins HOH. And for several days when Josh was HOH, he was saying in the house, I don't want to be that anymore. I want to be different. With the first time that Josh had any inkling of disobedience from Paul, it's when he was HOH. Suddenly he had a different label on himself. He had a different role to play in the house. And it completely changed the way he played the game, at least temporarily.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it, again, obviously applies to this season in particular when it comes to the bullying aspect. Like, it's very clear to see that, like, Josh is being used as a sort of prison guard in Big Brother 19, where, yeah, you know, Paul is saying, you are here to enforce our rules. You are here to, like, put them in their place, to rattle them. And Josh doesn't even like doing it. He cries after, like, most of the time. He's like, he's not enjoying it, but, like, it's gotten to a point where he can't even help but do it now. And even when he's saying things like, I'm not just going to, you know, do what Paul tells me to, and I don't think that we should be doing this anymore. It's he continues to do it. And as Dirt in the chat says, Big Brother scolded him as well, which is another source of, like, another authority figure here.
Right.
And I think that's what's causing a lot of his like internal strife, because he has two different authority figures telling him completely opposite things, and he's not really sure where to go.
Right, absolutely. And not to backtrack too much, but I saw a lot of people in the chat talking about, well, why didn't Cody follow into this? And why didn't Jessica follow into this? And I think that probably the argument there is that, you know, Cody and Jessica kind of got the label of prisoner, if you will. They became ostracized in the house. And so their roles sort of changed. And, you know, Cody had severe HOH-itis in week one. And then suddenly he didn't have that role anymore. And also, once you're on the outs, we're going to talk a little bit more about, like, cults and stuff in a little bit here. But, like, sort of once you are ostracized from a group, it's really hard to get back in, and sort of your brain clears up a little bit. Like, once you aren't part of that group, then it's like, why would I ever want to be in that group? It's hard when you're in it to see your way out of it. But once you're out of it, it's hard. You don't want to see your way back into that. So I think that probably we can look at Cody and say, you know, he got sort of put into that role because he got HOH and then he was ostracized. And so he never really got brought into Paul's, you know, cult of personality.
Yeah, and I think that also applies to how the audience sees them, because we often talk about how the audience will, like, almost always root for the underdog, mm-hmm. and the fact that Cody and Jessica became underdogs made them so rootable, despite the fact that a lot of people had problems with them personally, and they did go on a power trip in the first week. But I think that not only does it change how the audience views them, but it also probably changes their own behavior, because, as you mentioned, your role changes how you behave. And yeah. So people who are on the outs, who are the underdogs, are going to act in a different way than people who have power.
Right. And this brings up another interesting thing. It's good that you bring up the audience. So another takeaway from the Stanford Prison Experiment is what is called the Hawthorne effect, or the observer theory, which is that participants in any experiment, their behavior is modified if they know that people are watching. So this is actually a common criticism of the Stanford Prison Experiment, which is that the people knew that they were being observed. They knew that they were being watched. And so they were maybe encouraged to play into the prisoner and the guard behaviors because they knew that they were being watched. And I think this applies directly to the fact that it's a TV show. You know, you talk to the BB players and eventually they forget the cameras are there, but they never really do forget that they're on a TV show. And they know that there are expectations both from the audience and also from the producers. And I think this could work two ways in that we could say, well, if you know you're being watched and you know that the audience wants you to shake the house up and have big moves, you know, why aren't they doing that? But I also think that Paul is a vet. Paul is someone who got brought into the house and it's clear that the producers like Paul and want Paul to be there. And so, you know, the players don't know what the viewers actually want. The players probably think that Paul is a fan favorite because he came into the house as a fan favorite. So even though they might behave, they may be behaving in such and such a way because of what they think the producers and the audience want. They don't actually know what the audience wants. But that's another big takeaway, I think.
Yeah, and I think we see Paul often try to reinforce the idea that production likes him to the house guests as often as he can. Like, you know, we talked about it the other day where it's like he said, you know, they put that golden apple there in that first week for me, right? Yeah. Like, you know, that pendant of protection was meant for me because the audience who loves me would vote for me. And he's always talking about his fan base and like he doesn't want to disappoint his fans. Like he's constantly reinforcing just how many people like him to really cement the fact that he is an authority figure, I think.
Right. And we can see it too, even on non-returnee seasons or when these dominant players are not necessarily returnees. Like with Derek, he was on Team America, which I believe was kind of a secret. Like the house wasn't directly told who was in Team America, but multiple people were in Team America and they knew about it. And they probably talk to other people in the house. We can even see with Polly and Big Brother 18. He comes in as not a returnee, but he is a brother of a returnee. And so, or we can see in BBOTT and in a lot of recent seasons, these temptations or these care packages, those are clues about who the audience likes. And so that can affect the behavior of the people because they know that they're being watched and they know that the audience and the producers have an expectation of how that they should be behaving.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess one of my questions for you is like, how much do you think that people like Paul or Derek or Kim, like how much are they doing this consciously and how much is this just kind of like what naturally happens once you gain that power or is it different for each person?
So I think that it depends on the person, right? You know, Derek has an extensive education in sort of criminal justice and as an undercover cop. I would bet that Derek is familiar with a lot of these ideas and concepts. Someone like Paul, maybe not necessarily academically aware of these things, but you know, when you are getting the feedback of like, hey, this is working for me, I definitely think that you are encouraged to continue to behave that way. And also we can see in history, a lot of people who have become dictators and cult leaders, they are not necessarily super, super educated, or they might, you know, their dictatorships may have preceded a lot of these experiments. These are experiments and observations of things that happen naturally in the real world. So I do think that it's probably a little bit of both. And in Paul's case, he might be aware of some of these things, but it's more about, you know, results. He gets positive results by behaving this way.
Interesting. So, okay. So tell me about these comparisons that we can draw between, you know, these Big Brother figures or Survivor figures and maybe some historical figures.
All right, cool. So yeah, this is sort of where the podcast gets a little dark. We're going to be talking about these things. But I see a lot of comparisons in Paul's game to a lot of what happened in China in the 20th century. We're talking about Chairman Mao here. And the idea that there is always another enemy to go after. A couple days ago, or maybe a week or two ago now, Matt actually said in the house, oh, it's crazy how there's always a new enemy number one. Like, right, you know, right now it's Cody and Jessica, but like, oh, we're already talking about how Kevin is going to be new public enemy number one. It's funny how that happens. And to give a very, very, very brief and succinct summary of China in the 20th century, there was World War II happened, and the Japanese were the bad guys in World War II for the Chinese people, right? They were aggressors, and so the Chinese people were fighting against the Japanese. When that ended, there were two major powers in China. There were the nationalists and the communists, And Chairman Mao, he was on the communist side. And so he was able to start gaining more power because they had another enemy. We have to get these nationalists out, and then we will finally be good and be happy and have peace. Right. So then the Civil War ends. The nationalists flee to Taiwan and set up their own country. And then China is now communists. And one of the first things that Chairman Mao does is he proposes the Great Leap Forward. He wants to catch China up to the rest of the industrialized world. And so he ends up starting this crazy program where they are going to stop all industry and all farming and everything in China and focus entirely on industrializing. And also that he wanted to change the landlord system, the way that real estate and housing and landlords were all set up. And so suddenly the landlords were the bad guys, and also people who were against progress were the bad guys. And so then this happens for several years. And then suddenly the people who are the rightists are the bad guys. People, Chairman Mao starts saying, well, there are people that still exist in China that are sympathetic to the nationalist cause, even though the nationalists are already gone. And so they start targeting other bad guys. And then after they're gone, then we have secret rightists who are bad guys. Now there are people who are secretly even in the same government. And so what Chairman Mao does is he starts targeting other people sort of in his cabinet, like best friends of his, people who helped him gain power. He starts outing these people as secret conservatives or secret rightists. And so people like Peng Dehuai and Zhou Enlai and Deng Xiaoping all become people that are targeted, and a lot of them end up being killed or at least ousted because of this. And so then this leads into the Cultural Revolution. They end up having what they call a Cultural Revolution. They want to change, get rid of the old ways. And everyone who likes the old ways, they are bad. And so there is this crazy movement where in schools, Chairman Mao tells students to attack their teachers. And this literally actually happens. Millions and millions of teachers and people who are educators get murdered by their own students because Chairman Mao says, these are the bad guys. These are the people who are trying to ruin what is going to be our utopia. And so this is obviously really, really, really brief. But the idea is that there is always a new enemy to target. And there's always the idea of you should rat out your neighbor. If you see anything, say something. We see the same thing happening in North Korea to this very day. And the idea that you have to police yourself. You have to police your own neighborhood. And you should turn on your best friend sort of before they turn on you. And again, I'm super simplifying this. But Paul is doing a lot of this in the House where he has his core alliance. And then every couple of weeks, suddenly, like, the people on the bottom, they are the new bad guys. They are the new bad guys. And then, you know, we have to turn on them. And why we've been saying in the podcast for weeks now, like, why aren't they teaming up against Paul? But it's like, if someone speaks out, then they become the new public enemy number one.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, Tammy in the chat points out, like, we see it in our own country now, like in modern politics too. Like, we are often looking for an enemy, a new enemy to be fighting against, to rally the troops against, and we absolutely are seeing. I mean, that is one of the core elements of Paul's strategy here. Is and he's talked about this. Like, we know that he's actively doing this. Is that he is setting up new targets. He's making sure that everyone has somebody to be rallying against. And I think one of the biggest examples of the self-policing that we see comes from Boston Rob in Redemption Island.
Exactly.
Obviously, it happens a lot in any of these sort of dictatorship games, but Rob in Redemption Island in particular, with the buddy system and like everybody comes to him with all of the information. If anybody says any one thing out of line, then they get cut. And we saw it especially at the merge when Boston Rob takes out Matt for even questioning him for a moment. It really sends a message to everybody that, like, you do not question me. If you do, it doesn't matter who you talk to, even if it's the person that you may or may not be romantically linked to, it's gonna get back to me. Yep. And then if you were in on this, you're done. You're getting cut. And so I think this is a very effective strategy to sort of cow the rest of the players into submission. And it's another reason why we see them acting so scared, and like why we saw Elena this season so afraid to make any kind of move. Whereas, I mean, she is a very bold person, like a very bold personality. She gets into these screaming matches with people. I think under normal circumstances, Elena could have been a very bold player. But in this season, she was cowed into submission by Paul's tactics. And we saw her play very, very safe in a circumstance where maybe like she wouldn't have otherwise.
Absolutely. And another real history example of this sort of behavior. And again, this is a very sensitive topic. I'm going to try to discuss it sensitively. But during World War II, during the Holocaust in these concentration camps, there were capos or capos. And these were guards that were Jewish guards. The Nazis during World War II in these concentration camps, they would actually pick prisoners out of the camp and say, you are a guard now. And they were given special privileges. They were allowed to have their own private rooms. And in return, they had to monitor and abuse sort of their own fellow people. And this is another thing that people in history classes and in universities have been debating for decades now, is why did they do it? Why did they turn on their own people? Why did they listen to, you know, their own aggressors and act against their own self-interests, right? And I don't really have an answer for this, but it's a thing that happens in real life. The idea is like, you know, those people in those situations had very difficult decisions to make, because if they didn't agree to do it, then other people were going to fulfill that role and then they were going to be victimized. And again, I want to be very sensitive. I know we're deep going into serious stuff and this is just a silly fun game show. But again, these are real things that happen in real life with real people. And there are real people in the Big Brother house. And I think there are similar dynamics where you see people in the alliance, even though they know that Paul is probably going to come after them sooner rather than later. If you aren't with the power, you are the next target and you are sort of under the bootstrap or the heel. And so I think that we can see other comparisons there, too.
Yeah, and I mean, even now, you know, Jorge in the chat is asking, doesn't this strategy only work if you have weak players? And like, that's kind of what we're talking about here, because I don't think it does necessitate that they're weak players, because I think we saw everybody sort of fall under this trap. And the only people that haven't fallen under this trap this season, at the very least, are the people that Paul has already singled out as targets, right?
Yeah. Right. Last time you and I did a morning update, you asked me whether the things were happening because Paul is so good, or if production was helping him so much, or if the players were weak. And I don't really have an answer. I think that if it happened to everyone all the time, if every person was sort of subject to these psychological forces, then we would see it every time. And it doesn't happen every time. Sometimes it doesn't come up at all in some dynamics. And sometimes it happens for half a season. And then Paulie takes a big fall. Or sometimes it happens almost to the end and then someone like Vanessa or, you know, like gets cut right at the end. So I don't really have an answer for that. I do think that there is definitely a certain quality of personality dynamics that happen. Certain types of people are more and are less likely to fall under these forces. But you can't just pick a person, and you really can't say it about yourself, too. I think that really on average, the average person is likely to, just as likely as anybody else to fall under these circumstances.
Brett asks, how much does knowledge of the game have to do with this? So like, does knowing the game, the ins and outs, I mean, certainly that would help with the authority that, you know, the appearance of authority, correct? But there are some people like, you know, although I guess most of the people that we've seen operate this kind of strategy have been pretty familiar with the game. Do you think that's a necessary component?
Well, sure. I think that if you aren't like a scholar and you don't know about these things or whatever, like knowing that this strategy works in other situations might help. I think that knowing how people have won the game in the past can certainly come to help you. I think that if you know what a winning game is and you see it, then you can say that person's playing a winning game. We need to target them. And so we could say if you are strong enough in your BB history, then you might know that Paul needs to be targeted. But again, we're getting to a point where it's like, if you voice that opinion, if you voice that opposition, then, you know, you're on the outs, which brings me to the next thing that I kind of want to talk about. There's another experiment that's worth talking about. And just really quickly, it's called the Ash Conformity Experiment. And when these things happened, every time it happened, there was 8 people that sat in a circle and they were shown 2 cards. One card had a single line on it. And one card had three lines on it.
You're breaking
up
for me, John.
Lengths.
I don't know if it's happening for
you. And there was always an obvious answer. Like, they were asked which A, B, or C, which line is the same length?
Well, John, it may or may not be broken up.
And the answer was really, really obvious. There was one that was like super short, one that was the same length, and one that was super, super long.
He'll be back very soon, I'm sure. But yes, okay. We're getting him back. He's right here. Ready? There he is. All right. You back, John?
Hello.
And he's gone.
Okay. I think I'm starting to record on the Zencaster. Let's reconnect here.
So, you know, this was John's thing. So I'm just gonna, you know, keep talking until I can get him back again. It should be another like ready. And
hello?
There he is. And
hello?
He's not there. Okay.
hello.
Well, I don't know. This stuff is very interesting to me. It's the idea that. All this like psychology stuff can be applied to Big Brother. It's one of the reasons why I got into Big Brother in the first place was to you know, be able to make these kinds of comparisons and draw this kind of analysis from it. Here is John. All right, so let's get back into this this Ash conformity experiment that you're talking about. Yes, I can see you.
Oh, good. I was about to restart the whole computer. Right. So yeah, there's a group of people, they have to pick which line is the right length. But again, this is sort of a deceptive experiment because the first seven people in the group of eight people were cohorts. They were all actors and they were always going to answer uniformly. So the first seven people said, it's A, it's A, it's A, it's A. And then the eighth person is the only person actually being experimented on. And what ended up happening is it was a test of, well, are you going to conform to the group or are you going to say what the obvious right answer is? And again, on these cards, the answers were completely obvious. There was a control group that was done where there was no pressure to conform.
Connection issues.
I don't know what's happening.
Yeah. Well, I think I know about this. I think you're probably good now.
Okay, good.
But just to clear up some of what you said, I believe you were saying there's eight people in the study. Seven of them are basically like actors. They're in on the study, and then one of them is the real person being studied on, right? And so they're asked a question with an obvious answer, and they have everybody else give the wrong answer. To see what the actual person being studied on will say. Will they say the wrong answer because everyone else has said it, or will they say the right answer, the real answer that they see right in front of their face?
Right. So in the control group where there wasn't any conformity issues and they were just allowed to do what they wanted, the person got the answer right 99% of the time. Makes sense. And then in the test, in the experimental group where there was the pressure to conform and seven people before them got the wrong answer, the person being experimented on only got the answer right 60% of the time, which is more than half. But again, these were obvious wrong answers. And 40% of the time, the person gave what was willingly a wrong answer because the seven people in front of them gave the same answer. And as a matter of fact, 5% of the participants got every single answer wrong. They were always with the crowd. And 70% of the participants gave some wrong answers, meaning that the pressure to conform with them was great enough that they acted against their own interests some of the time. And again, I think this is another thing that you have obvious comparisons to things like whether we're talking about Dr. Will or Boston Rob or Paul, is that we have this group think mentality. We have this idea of this is what the house wants. This is what the house wants. We're going to do what the house wants. And even if you know that it's the wrong move, and even if you know that it's bad for your own game, there is a lot of pressure there. And we can see that people conform to this pressure all the time.
Yeah, and like to be clear, like the answers to these questions were very obvious,
yes,
right? Like
right.
It was like which line is the longest, where one of the lines is clearly longer than the other, and they're literally looking at two lines where there's a really long one and a really short one, and they're saying, yeah, the short one is longer because that's what everyone else said.
Yeah, again, in the control group, when there wasn't any of this pressure to conform, when they were just told to answer the question, the testers got it right 99 to 100% of the time. These were very easy questions, but they still conformed to the group. And there's a whole theory in psychology or in sociology, which is called emergent norm theory. And it's this idea of group think. And Turner and Killian are the scientists related here, and they have some quotes here. They say that norms emerge within the crowd at the beginning of any situation where crowds show up. there's very little unity, but after a little bit of milling about, key charismatic members of the group start suggesting appropriate actions, and all of the other members fall in line. Key members have distinctive personalities and behaviors, such of which garner attention. And when the crowd does not give negative feedback, the crowd as a whole legitimizes that person. And this is how we get into situations of mob mentality. So at the beginning of the game, we have a situation where there isn't necessarily anything going on. People are just milling about. We have little pocket alliances. People are just like, I kind of like you. I'll talk to you. But someone emerges and becomes the voice of reason and says, we're going to do this. And this is a thing that happens in crowds all the time. People study crowds as if they're individuals, and they study crowd dynamics. And this happens in the real world. It happens with mobs and riots, and it happens in the Big Brother house, too. We get this idea of what the house wants, this whole groupthink mentality.
Yeah, you also mentioned the cult of personality to me. Where does that fit into all this?
All right, so the cult of personality is a thing that is often talked about in relation to dictators, especially if we're talking about North Korea or indeed China with Chairman Mao. Also, Joseph Stalin is another person that's brought up a lot when we're talking about the cult of personality. To the people listening in the comments, we are going to do the spoilers in just a minute. This is sort of, we didn't know we were going to get the spoilers. This is the discussion because we don't have live feeds. But anyway, a cult of personality is where it's a political phenomenon that arises when a person is idealized as heroic or infallible. And basically people follow that person. And in some cases, such as with a lot of the dictators in North Korea, they even get worshipped. They get seen sort of as gods. And again, I know that's a very serious topic, but there are comparisons, I think, to players who play a dominant game. And I think that when you have these returning players, they are seen in such a light. And you have people that are charismatic. Say anything you want about people like Dan and Dr. Will and Boston Rob and Paul, but they are certainly charismatic. And we get this cult of personality behind them. We see Alex in the house this season talking all about friendship being a brand or being a franchise, something that Paul can't go against. And in real life, in these political situations, it doesn't really matter what the actual person does. When there's this cult of personality, this idea that this person is above or infallible or greater than, it's so hard to break those perceptions.
Yeah, and I think we very easily see this with Alex, where, you know, Paul is constantly lying to everybody in the house, and he's letting Alex know. Meanwhile, she's saying Paul can't lie because he's all about friendship. And like that idea of like Paul and friendship and that cult of personality has made a perception that is completely against reality, but she continues to believe it. And we're sitting here on our couches being like, what are you doing? Why are you saying this? It's absurd. But it is something that's again, like very easy to fall into if you're in that position.
And the thing is that with the pressure to conform, what we were talking about earlier with the emergent norms theories and the Ashes conformity experiments, sometimes we say things even if we don't believe them because of that pressure to conform. And then if enough people start saying a thing, then it sort of makes it so. How many times have we always said perception is reality in the Big Brother house? And that's really what this comes down to, is a matter of people say things, and even if they don't believe it in their head, they say it. And then if enough people start saying it, then you're like, well, maybe everyone does think this. And eventually you start saying it enough that maybe you kind of believe it somewhere in your own head. And the last thing, this is the last thing that I want to talk about, and then we can get into the spoilers. There was a sociologist named Max Weber who developed classifications of authority. So there are three different major types of authority, and I don't remember the other two because they're not important. I think one is political and one is like judicial, but one of his classifications is charismatic authority. And he said that cults of personality arise around figures that exhibit charismatic authority. And so there are three defining characteristics of charismatic authority. There is charisma, there is legitimization, and then the routinization of charisma. And so very briefly, charisma, the person has qualities which set them apart. They're charismatic. Legitimization, the power is legitimized based on the leader's exceptional qualities, insight, or accomplishment, or some external force. Something legitimizes their authority. And then the third fact is the routinization of charisma. The authority is succeeded by a bureaucracy. You get sort of steps. You get sort of like a bureaucracy. We have the A, B, and C to do. And again, the comparisons with Paul or Boston Rob, I think that they're really obvious. Obviously, we're talking about people that are very charismatic. They are legitimized by their title as a returning player, or they were legitimized by their title. You know, Dr. Will was a doctor. I know that Derek doesn't really fit this because he didn't tell people that he was undercover cop or whatever. But they get legitimized by their own sort of personal things they say, or by other people in the house who legitimize them, or by the other powers that be. And by, you know, having Paul come into the house as the returning player, he gets legitimized. And then the routinization of the charisma, I think you see that in Paul saying, okay, this is what's happening in week one. This is what's happening in week two. This is what's happening in week three. Yes, Tarek in the comments said, Dan is a coach. That's another situation where Dan is the coach. He's saying, this is what's going to happen here. This is what's going to happen there. And that's how these power structures get set up. And that's how you get into the idea of the cult of personality. And again, I think that the comparisons are pretty obvious.
Yeah, and you know, I actually talked about this the other day, where it's like these twists, like the temptation competition or battle of the block, it gives the players more things to have to contend with. And with somebody like Paul, who is now like every other day, like giving them instructions, like here's our new task, here's our new mission. It is routine. It is making it routine for him to be giving them these instructions, and it's really solidifying his power. Correct?
Yeah, definitely. And we can also see it sort of just with if you want to do the Boston Rob comparison and the buddy system. And he was always checking in with his foot soldiers, and he was always saying like, "This is what we're doing today." You know, Paul does this too. It's always checking in. You are routinely saying, let's have a meeting at 12 o'clock. We're gonna cover this. We're gonna make sure that we're here. You know, you check in time and time and time again, and that routinely makes it makes it a structure. It makes it the power that is. It makes it what is going on. And it's so hard to break down power structures, whether we're talking about a goofy, fun game with Uncle Austin's fart trailer, or if we're talking about actual human lives in politics.
Yes. All right. So I think this is a fascinating discussion. I think, you know, even when you are frustrated by watching this kind of gameplay, you know, it really does sort of hamper the excitement that you might have for the season. I think there is some interesting stuff to look at. And hopefully this podcast has helped you. Maybe you'll pay a little more attention to what Paul's doing, and you'll find a little bit more enjoyment in like seeing why it's happening at the very least, even if you are frustrated by it. And also, I think there's real like insight into the idea that this really could be any of us. Like, as much as we like to armchair quarterback and say, if we were in there, we would know better. And people did this to Dan, like, oh, I would never have fallen for the funeral, as though they even they don't even understand what he did in the funeral. Like, right. Like any of us could fall victim to this. And especially in an isolated environment where these are the only people that you're around, it is very, very much like a psychological experiment. And I think that we sometimes forget that when we look at Big Brother. We sometimes get caught up in the gameplay or the drama, and we forget that it actually can be an interesting thing to look at in terms of like the psychology of what's happening.
Yeah, I think that what you said is very important, is the idea that it's isolated. We see it in Survivor and we see it in Big Brother. You are not able to talk to somebody else. You are not able to turn the TV on. You're not able to listen to, you know, music. I know the HOHs sometimes get CDs and things like that, but you are stuck in the situation. And I think you could even say that the reason it happens more often in Big Brother than in Survivor is because you are even more confined. At least in Survivor, you can go for a walk or take an aqua dump or whatever you need to do. You can't do any of that in the Big Brother house. And I think that probably leads to it happening a little more often in the Big Brother house. You have no external thing. We see that in cults all the time. The reason that cults happen, people like Jim Jones and things, it's all about controlling information. These people get taken away. They're not allowed to communicate to the outside world. And again, very serious. I don't want to make it sound like that's the same as a silly reality game, but there are a lot of dynamics that are comparisons to those things. Before we get into the spoilers, I want to drop some references here. If you are interested in any of these things, if you didn't completely hate this discussion, there are a couple great books that I would recommend. There's a book called Nothing to Envy by Barbara Demick. It is a book of interviews with escaped North Koreans, people who escaped from North Korea. There's an author named Jung Chang who wrote a lot of personal histories of China. Her two books, Wild Swans and Mao, The Untold Story, are really, really great books. There is a really good book from actually the 1800s that is still very popular and very important today called Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds by Charles McKay. That book is in the public domain. You can find it for free anywhere. If you want to go to YouTube, a lot of footage from the Stanford Prison Experiments and the Milgram Experiments was filmed and is now on YouTube. You can actually watch the unfiltered footage from that. And there also have been documentaries made that are on Netflix and are on YouTube. And then if you are interested in the learning more about World War II and the way that this, you know, happened in the Holocaust, the works of Elie Wiesel, specifically his book Night, is very, very, very important. And there's a book called The Seventh Cross or Die Siebte Kreuz by Anna Zegers that's also a very good read. Those are all, if you're interested in any of this, and if you didn't hate today, check those things out.
All right, and we will try to post links or at least the list of these books and resources in the post for this podcast. And I'm sure, John, you can also tweet this out, right?
Yeah, I'll tweet the list or a picture of the list or something. And feel free to add me or DM me or whatever.
So make sure you follow at John Krause on Twitter. That's K-R-A-U-S-E. And there's no H in John either. if you want to get those books. But let's get into the spoilers here. As we mentioned, we didn't know that we were going to get spoilers. We didn't know there was anything to update.
Right.
But there is something to update. There is somebody on Reddit who has been providing spoilers all season long. They've been proven right every single time, so there's no reason to doubt the validity of what they're saying. If you don't want spoilers, I know that sometimes even the people who regularly watch the feeds don't want to be spoiled on this because they didn't get a chance to see it on the feeds. If you want to know, then you can stay tuned. If you don't want to know, this is your chance to bounce out. I do not have a song for you, unfortunately, but here's your chance to leave. So without any further ado, we'll talk about the spoilers. There's really not a whole lot to talk about. We don't know much apart from who won, but we do know who won the HOH, and the person that won the HOH is none other than Christmas Joy, John.
Yeah, Christmas Joy. So congratulations on another HOH to Paul. I think this is a new record. I think we're at 6 or 7 in a single season now for him. That's really good.
Yeah, it's crazy. I think a lot of people were probably hoping that that Mark could pull one out, but looking like that's not going to happen. If I would guess, the nominations are almost certainly going to be Mark and Matt,
right,
or something along those lines. Maybe even Mark and Raven to not, you know, freak Matt out, putting him up so many times in a row. But it does seem as though Mark is in a position where he yet again needs to win the veto. Actually, and now that I'm thinking about it, they may not put Mark up on the block. They may try to backdoor him as they've been doing for a little while. So we may see Josh and Matt or something along those lines, because they don't want to freak Matt out by putting Matt and Raven. And so they'll try to backdoor Matt. I would not be surprised if that was the case. Mark. Mark has been going on a competition spree at this point. He's been immune for 4 weeks in a row. So it would not surprise me at all if they were scared of him winning this veto.
I have a question for you, and I don't know if you know this, but what do you know about, are they ending the temptation competition? Because I know that they said that they're introducing a new temptation into the house.
As far as I'm aware, the temptation competition is no longer in effect. There will be two nominees and the HOH. So it will be more difficult to backdoor somebody. Actually, I know the temptation competition, the idea was that it would make it harder to backdoor somebody, but it actually, I think, made it easier because of the way that they were able to game the system, where Matt was able to throw the competition to prevent Cody from guaranteeing himself a shot at the veto. And then once Cody was not able to play, there were only two chips to draw instead of three, which lowered his chances of being picked. Obviously, with nine people left in the house, three chips to be pulled to play in the veto, Mark has a much better shot. Still not a great shot, but a much better shot than Cody did at being picked here.
Yeah, let's do that math. So if there are nine people in the house and three of them, there's going to be the HOH and the two noms, they're already playing, which means there are six people left to be drawn from and three chips are going to be drawn. So Mark has a 50% chance of being in the veto either way.
Well, actually, something that I think people usually forget is that the names of the people playing are, in fact, still in the bag.
Right.
Because if they get chosen, then they have house guest pick.
So he has like a 30% chance or about 40.
Yeah, something along those lines. So it's not the worst. It's not the worst chances in the world. But even if he does get picked, he has to win it, which he's been doing pretty well at. But it does look like we may be getting another slow week here of just Mark kind of waltzing out the door, and no real shakeup, unfortunately. But again, you know, we just talked about all of these different aspects. And I mean, this is just Paul, again, maintaining control. He really did a good job during the double eviction, managing to get Jason to be the one to take out Elena. I mean, that really just like it puts a wedge in his relationship with Mark. Any relationship that could have been there probably is not going to be there. Right. And as we talked about, this was like an example of Paul's control over the house, and in getting Elena out, and in the way that it happened, this was probably one of the best case scenarios for Paul, to be honest.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, he's got a lot of people that would definitely do whatever he wants. So I can't think of anyone other than Mark winning the HOH that would have not put Mark on the block at some point. So I do think that Mark has a work up ahead of him. I'm going to go ahead and predict that Matt and Raven are going to be the two nominees, just because they are so happy to be nominated as pawns that I think I can see that happening. The only reason I would see maybe Josh being nominated, like you're saying, is to ensure that he plays in the veto. But I mean, if Matt and Raven are both happy to volunteer, which they both are, then I could see them going up just to make it easy.
Yeah, I'm guessing like the conversations might go something along the lines of like Matt and Raven saying like, what, why are we getting put up if we both sucked in the last veto? Like, aren't you, or shouldn't you be putting up good competitors? Why is it always us? I could see that maybe starting to happen, but you know, knowing Matt and Raven, they'll probably just be like, oh yeah, great. Right. Go team. Somebody asked, if Mark wins the veto, who do we think is going to be targeted here?
Probably Matt,
especially,
right?
Especially with Christmas in charge, I think it'll probably be Matt. I think they'll finally pull the trigger on Matt. I actually, watching the double eviction, I thought they might, you know, secretly go for Matt when he was up on the block next to Elena. The order was, or it was supposed to be, Mark and then Matt. Yeah. So Elena would stay in the game. But obviously, I think part of why they didn't was because there really wasn't enough time to orchestrate something like that. And then also with Mark still in the house, you kind of can't leave him in there with Elena as well. That's an obvious duo. And it doesn't really make sense to target your own numbers at that point.
Right. I would agree with that. It was so frustrating last night. And I know that it was kind of a foregone conclusion, and I don't know if anyone could have said or done anything, but every time that, you know, Julie was like, let's check in on the house guests, and just Mark and Elena were just not even trying. They weren't talking to anybody. That was just really frustrating to watch, because you got to at least try. And I know we just had like an hour discussion about why that sort of thing happens, but let's not divorce that from reality, like in our expectations and what we wish for. I would have really wanted to see someone try just to say something, just say like, hey, how about not me? How about not voting me out? Like, what do you think?
When Jason was like, I've got a speech, Mark, I've got a speech, I just wanted to be like, well, tell me right now what your reasons are and we can address it and maybe change things up. some people also mentioned that maybe Kevin would be targeted because we know Paul is after Kevin. I think that's definitely a possibility. I actually could see that. I could see Paul being a little nervous to start targeting Matt and Raven while Mark is still in the house. He might take it as an opportunity to pull the trigger on Kevin. Would Christmas be up for that? Probably. Even though they have a good relationship, Paul's been pretty successful at turning Christmas. So if Paul does try to turn the target onto Kevin, and then Kevin wakes up and starts revealing a bunch of information, maybe we will see an interesting week. Who knows? Right. But there we are. That's our week.
I'm excited at the prospect. I've been, granted, it's my own bias, but I've been a very, very vocal Kevin fan from day one. So maybe it's wishful thinking, but I think that if he catches wind that he's targeted, or if he gets put on the block at any point, I think that he will kick it into overdrive. And again, that might be my bias, but whereas people like Jason and Alex, I think no matter what, will just sort of do what they're told. I think Kevin is in a position where he's like, he knows where he sits, and he's working with that. And I think if that breaks for him, that he will do what it takes. We've seen him willing to talk to Cody and willing to work with other people. So that's kind of my hope.
All right. Well, this has been a very fun podcast. I hope everyone enjoyed the little change of pace here. I really enjoyed talking about this, so hopefully you guys did as well. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. We will be back tomorrow at noon Eastern to update you on what happens on the feeds. I will have Liana Boris with me. She will finally be returning for Liana Saturdays. And we'll also be live tonight after the special Friday night episode, where Derek will be in the house. We'll have two dictators in the house at the same time. I wonder what that's going to be like. I believe I'm going to be on that podcast. I'm not sure who's going to be joining me, but always a fun podcast to recap these special episodes. So keep on the lookout for that. And of course, check out the Taran Show with Jordan Parhar. That was very, very fun. So thank you everyone for joining us. We will see you next time.